Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip.
Becky Vieira is a writer and author of Enough About the Baby, a guide to surviving the first year of motherhood. She's a writer for parenting outlets Baby Center and Scary Mommy in the United States and hosts the Instagram account at Witty Otter.
So a very warm welcome, Becky. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, because your book, Enough About the Baby, had me chuckling and laughing over the summer holiday. I took it with me and I wanted to sort of share it with our audience as a wonderful lived experience of first time motherhood.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. Thank you so much. I put a lot of my own self and my own story in that book. So it's wonderful to hear that it resonated with another mother.
And even though it was 16 years since I first became a mother, I could have written that book in terms of the experience.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what sort of prompted you. Why did you have to get that book out of your system, as it were?
I had to, yes, get it out of my system. That's a great way to say it. Kind of cleanse myself of my experience as a new mother, which wasn't the best. We go into motherhood being told it's going to be the best time of your life and it's magical and your life's going to change. And it sounds like, you know, unicorns are going to descend upon you. And it's not like that. And there's a lot of things that are very hard that people don't talk about. You hear, oh, you'll be tired. Yes, sometimes the baby doesn't sleep. You worry about them. But those are all very basic. The fact that no one goes into the idea that you are so tired that you might hallucinate, as I did, that sleep deprivation is a form of torture. And the extent to which mothers experience it is torturous. It's beyond what anyone should go through. I also found my husband and I were fighting. I was not connecting with a lot of my friends, and I completely lost who I was. I didn't see myself as anything other than this part of this almost like conveyor belt where it was feeding, diapering, burping, washing my baby, putting him to sleep, starting all over again. It was almost like I was kind of this cog in the system and that I completely lost myself. I hadn't heard anyone else really describe it the way I was experiencing things. And because of that, I assumed that I was just a bad mother, that no one else was having these hard times but me, and that I wasn't doing something right. Lo and behold, my experience is almost universal. And once I found that out, I thought, this is something that other moms need to know. I wanted to almost go back in time and help the old me, the new mom me, and anyone else who came after me with this information.
Well, very amusingly, I remember I had a very similar experience. And about 3 months after my first son had been born, I went back to the group sessions that the parenting classes that we had to sort of teach us to look after baby. And I asked the teacher if I could have 10 minutes with the parents in the room. And I said to them all, listen, guys, this is like a bomb dropping in your lives. Be prepared, you know. And I told them all the things that nobody had ever told me. And reading about them in your book is even the first time I've seen some of those things written down in that way.
Yeah. How was that received by the women when you gave them that information?
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because you and I will probably also acknowledge that it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to us.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't, you know, nobody wanted to be a mother more than I did, but it doesn't take away from the chronic loneliness that can accompany first-time parenthood
And also some of it can be traumatic, certainly in terms of things like the birth for many people. Mm-hmm. So I think that the mothers in the room didn't really maybe want to hear the message at that point, but I tell you what, their partners did. And I remember the dads furiously writing down tips that I was giving them, tips about things to be ready for anything, tips right. that if you were lucky enough to have a partner in that circumstance, you really had to step up. And I was one of those people. And I think this might be unique to living in a big city. You know, we didn't have that village. We didn't have that community. We didn't have relatives next door. We were completely on our own. And I think that is a very singular experience. So a lot of those partners in the room were going, wow, we need to get some, you know, somebody up to help over those first few weeks, somebody to cook for my wife, somebody to, you know, support and help in the first few days, maybe with our take our dog for a walk, you know, right. they were really listening.
Right. And I do think that's a big part of this. Our partners, not intentionally, I don't think anyone wakes up one morning and thinks, gee, how can I best not support my wife or my girlfriend or the mother of my child right now? It's not intentional, but no one truly understands what it entails and what is happening to us mentally, physically, emotionally, all of those things, unless you've been a mother yourself. And this information absolutely is wonderful for partners to really understand and put themselves in our shoes maybe for a moment. I've had a lot of men who are past the point of being new fathers whose kids are, you know, range in any age. And they've almost had like just a pain like that they are looking back and didn't realize what their partners went through at the time and wish that they had known ahead of time. And I remember even my own father asked my mom and said, was it this hard? And she said, yes. And he said, could I have done something more or better? And she said, yes, because it's that lack of understanding and awareness that also feeds into this whole big issue, which is motherhood is a mess. It's not sustainable as is. It is twisted. The expectations are unreal, and it needs a lot of help and a lot of work.
And I was lucky. I didn't have phones and social media when my son was born, so I couldn't compare my kind of exhausted existence to the perfect mothers on social media. Yeah. Maybe yeah. some of the celebrities' moms who look absolutely perfect, you know, and everything is going beautifully. So I think that I was lucky in that regard, but I think certainly the sort of toxic perfectionism and expectation that lives on social media is another battle for many young moms, you know?
It's awful. I do look at social media as a double-edged sword. For me, that was where I got my first validation from other mothers that I wasn't alone. There's a lot of reality, there's a lot of openness, and there's a lot of truth. But to your point, it can also be very toxic. There are women who have 5 kids and they're all dressed alike and they're sitting in their perfectly clean home. And you see things like that. And for me, well, I was wearing the same clothes I had been wearing for the 3 days. I had breast milk stains on my shirt. I was beyond exhausted. My house looked like a bull had charged through it. And I would see things like that, and it wouldn't inspire me. It wouldn't encourage me. It defeated me. It deflated me. It crushed me. And it's just really hard. It's, you know, they say comparison is the thief of joy. And it's true because we can't compare. But also, those images, they make me so angry because they're lies. No one's house looks like that. Maybe the picture looks like that, that shot within that one frame. But I guarantee you, if you panned out, it wouldn't look like that in the rest of the house. There's got to be some sort of chaos, some sort of toy, some sort of mess, because we're humans and we have children and life just isn't that perfect for anyone.
The beautiful thing about your book is the humor, because I know, as someone who sort of talks a lot in this area, humor is a great component of resilience. And even if we can retrospectively look back and even chuckle a little bit, I mean, your book had me really chuckling about some of the details that I've often shared in private with friends, but, you know, the experience of, you know, maybe doing or saying things that you would never otherwise, you know, experience, except, you know, you've had a baby.
Yeah.
It was really quite funny. And I think, you know, you had me reflecting on, I think I had a 3-week-old and I was sort of walking down the street and a woman actually stopped me and asked me if I was okay. This is in London where nobody speaks to each other.
Wonderful.
She said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "My baby doesn't sleep." And she said, "Oh, don't worry. They will sleep eventually." And I said, "Really?"
Oh, bless her heart. She had no idea what a gift she was giving you with that.
And I think your book, it has the humor, but also it does convey the loneliness. Even if you're in a loving relationship, even if you're, you know, the happiest person alive to be with your baby, there is a loneliness that can accompany this experience. Certainly, you know, really characterized in the sort of the description, you know, even of feeling sort of disaffected from your own body, that kind of body grief, you know, the recalibration that has to happen in our relationships. You know, you did convey that really well.
Thank you. There's no area of our lives that will remain untouched after the birth of our babies. And not only that, I think that we don't give ourselves enough credit that beyond all of that other stuff, we have changed fundamentally. We are no longer in the world as a single woman or a married woman or even a pregnant woman. We are a mother. And that is, it's a huge thing, but it's also, there's a period of adjustment for us. And we don't, so technically you become a mother, right? Once you're pregnant or once your baby is born. But I think, you know, emotionally, it takes us much more than that. So there's a lot of shifts going on just in the way we perceive ourselves as well. And the magnitude, I think, is something that even moms themselves don't recognize until we point it out. And then it's kind of stepping back and saying, you know, you're right. That happened. And that could have played a role in so many things that you can reflect back on, like you said. There's things that I still hear and I still learn and I can kind of piece it together with things that I went through. And it does give me a sense of calm and a sense of peace to know that while none of this is normal, it's common.
That's right. And I think one of the things that you convey very nicely is that the relationship with our baby is something that can take time. And when we are chronically fatigued, often in pain in those first few weeks, you know, bonding is sometimes not at the top of our agendas.
And absolutely,
it does take time to develop that attachment, which of course is so important, but it is hard when you are physically and mentally depleted.
It's very hard. And that was actually one of the best gifts I received from writing this book, because when my son was born, I loved him. He was adorable. I had waited to be a mother. I was beyond happy, but I looked at him and it was just kind of, okay, this is great. But I didn't have that moment of, you know, the clouds parting and angels singing and feeling like my life had been transformed. It wasn't like that. I was bleeding. I was breastfeeding, which was incredibly painful. I had my midsection sewn back together. And as you said, I was exhausted and none of that really left me in a happy spot, in a happy state. I was in this kind of period of like chaos as I was adjusting to everything. And I felt such immense guilt because so many women say, oh, and I looked at the child and, you know, all those things that I said didn't happen to me happened to them. And one of the experts I interviewed for my book, Dr. Christine Sterling, she explained that that's really not how bonding happens. It's through our brains that first we're conditioned to take care of these babies. And through that, we almost fall in love. So that, sure, maybe this bonding is instant for some people, but for the majority of us, it's not, whether we realize that or not. And it wasn't me that was having the challenge to bond, I was following the normal trajectory of bonding. And hearing that, I just began sobbing. I couldn't control the tears. It was just this, you know, like someone came along and absolved me of this guilt and these feelings, anger I had toward myself to know that it wasn't just me. And I think a lot of women, I know for a fact, a lot of women, because I've spoken to them, have gone through that exact same situation.
Absolutely. And I remember when our son was born, my husband at 3 o'clock in the morning realized, he said to me, you know, if we don't feed him, he's going to die. I was like, that's right. But yes. I could hardly sort of see the wood for the trees. You know, if you made it into a sitcom, it would be quite amusing. So as you say, survival is absolutely, that's front, you know, feeding this baby, making sure this baby's having enough food is absolutely, you know, a primeval kind of, you know, a foundation for anything. We're not thinking about anything else at that point.
And you don't really need to be. And that's another thing that I like to stress. Those first few weeks, they're not going to look like the photos you see on social media. You're not going to sit there with your dog and your partner and your baby in this state of bliss. It's going to be hard. Everything you expected could change. Your baby might not even be sleeping in their nursery. Maybe they scream when you take them in the nursery. Maybe they scream when you put them in their bassinet. Nothing that you had planned is necessarily going to go as expected. And I think that we don't realize that. And obviously when we set these expectations for ourselves and they don't come true, things come crumbling down around us. So I think it's important for women to know that all you need to do in those first few weeks is survive, is get through, is learn your baby, learn how your baby's cues, what your baby needs, what your baby likes and doesn't like. Feed the baby, change the baby, diaper the baby, and you're good. Make sure you eat, make sure you sleep as much as you can, but don't expect these beautiful storybook moments to happen because that's not the time.
When I read your book, I realized, because I never, ever, ever slept when my baby slept. When my baby slept, I was doing washing or yes. cleaning or, you know, it was sometimes they say those things in books and it just doesn't happen. But as you say, it's about coping and it's about survival. And this is a sort of a period of time that is very acute, isn't it? It doesn't last forever, yes. but it is a period of time we need to be realistic about.
Yes. And I think for me and for a lot of others, we don't see that there's an ending. And especially when you haven't gone through something before, it seems never ending. I remember the pain of my C-section and thinking it would never end. And then I reflected back on a friend who had a C-section and kind of remembered when her baby was about 2 months old, we had gone out and, you know, done some things. And so I had that in my head, like, okay, she was physically okay by then. So I will be too. And that helped a lot. And I think knowing that those first few weeks, this chaos time, the survival time is for now, but not forever. And I'll be honest, you know, it's not practicing what I preach isn't the goal. It's talking about it and making everyone aware and knowing that it's hard for me too. My son is about to turn 7, and only within maybe the last year have I began to embrace letting the dishes go, letting the house go, because there's something bigger that needs to happen. And a lot of times that's me going to bed.
Absolutely. It's about prioritization, yeah. isn't it? And I think the one of the things, as someone who's got children who are a little bit older, so 16 and 14, if people aren't interested in the telling of your story, in what you went through during that first pregnancy and that first experience of motherhood, it can kind of haunt you. And I think, you know, it's kind of like a joke in our family where I say, I want to tell them about the story, you know, of the first few weeks, but they're not interested anymore.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But the reason for that is if women don't have the opportunity to tell their story in some format, it keeps coming back. And I think that your book reminds us of the absolute, you know, in a serious fashion, the importance of retelling a story so that we can understand what actually happened to us, because it's so easy to just move past these extraordinary experiences of giving birth and coping with a new life, because it's happened for centuries. Millions and billions of people have been through that experience. But if your story isn't heard, it can have a very difficult, I think, a psychological impact.
Absolutely. Someone needs to hear everyone's story. Whether it's one person, 1 million, 1 billion people, there's someone out there who needs to hear your story specifically, all of us. And sometimes maybe that's ourselves. So, you know, talking about it, sharing openly, which, as you said, sometimes people aren't receptive to that. So you have to choose your audience, but sometimes we just need to get it out. Maybe it's just writing it down, journaling, kind of going through it yourself, because I think there is sort of a peace and a forgiveness that we can give ourselves looking back and knowing that we were doing the best we could with what we had and trying to survive and loving our babies. And that's the best we could do, whether we thought that at the time or not.
And also, I think you can look back on that earlier version of yourself as a mother with enormous pride.
Yeah.
And you're so proud of yourself and you can't believe, you know, how well you coped. And I think that your book also reminded me of, I think, even though we're probably all better off than a lot of people in the rest of the world, you know, if we're living in these big cities, you know, often the concept of that village is defunct. You know, there are a lot of people struggling on their own, you know, and modern life, it doesn't mean we're living in villages with lots of people handling and helping the baby. We are often very much alone in that task.
There is no village. There is no village. The village is, you know, a bag of magic beans that someone is trying to tell us. You hear there's a village. It takes a village. That's all true. But the concept of the village is very outdated and it doesn't exist. One thing that I think is interesting is that whenever feelings of doubt or expressing needing help or worries about that, we're always reassured, don't worry, you have your village. And sometimes I think it's society's way of helping us by not helping us, stepping back. You're a superhero. You can do it. You have your village, meaning don't look to the rest of the world to help you. My mother had a village. Things were very different. I was raised in the late 70s, early 80s. A lot of mothers were stay-at-home moms. We had a neighborhood full of kids. We could go to each other's houses. The other mothers would babysit for us. There really was that community. That doesn't exist today. A lot of us are working moms. There are more mothers working right now than ever before. We're very isolated because of technology and social media, and we don't connect the way we used to. But beyond that, we're not in the same places anymore. We're not necessarily in the same town as our family or even our closest friends. I moved to a new town when I was 7.5 months pregnant. I knew no one. So beyond my husband and my parents coming to visit, it was just me when he was at work. And I think this village is something we all aspire to have. I remember looking around and thinking, where's mine? Was I supposed to get it? It's a great theory, but it's not a reality. We can build a village.
You talk about the friendships that you had to cultivate to sort of hope. And I did that as well. And those friendships were everyday friendships, were so supportive, so essential, weren't they? Even if they weren't the kind of the friendships that we had established through our lives, they were in our community, full of advice, able to hold the baby while you had a coffee, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I had to put myself in uncomfortable situations. And for me, that was entering a room of strangers, making myself vulnerable and reaching out to these other mothers. I signed up for mommy and me type classes. And the first one I went to, the class was great. The women were lovely, but I quickly learned just because we had a baby, it didn't connect us. I mean, there was that general connection, but it didn't connect us necessarily on a friendship level. And I expected, oh, you had a baby, I had a baby. Obviously, we're going to be best friends. But you also realize if you hadn't been close, if there wasn't, you know, a chance that you would have been close with this person before your baby, then they're not going to become your best friends once you have babies. I left that class alone still, and I was sad, and I, you know, I didn't know what was going on, if it was me. So I pushed myself and I signed up for another class, and I did that whole thing again, only this time it worked and I did connect with some women. And it didn't happen. We didn't immediately hold each other's babies and do things together. It's like anything, like building a friendship and building a trust. And before long, it was just amazing. I remember one day my son was maybe 10 months old and I was going to get my eyebrows waxed for the first time. And I was planning to bring him with me. And I had mentioned this to a friend and she looked at me and laughed and said, "Why would you do that? Drop him off at my house." And that was my village. It started there, and it's necessary and needed. And we've moved a lot and I've had to go through that process several times. It is hard. It is so hard. It is so uncomfortable, but it's necessary. And it works.
You learn all these new skills.
And people say, "Oh, that's impossible." It works to some degree for everyone. Some of us create this wonderful big village. Some it's one friend. We lived in San Francisco for several years and I just had this one best friend and we were each other's village. And it was enough for us at that point. Now that my son's in school, it's a lot more moms, but there's ways to do it and to find people.
That's right. And these people live with you forever. You know, I had an next door neighbor that I didn't really know very well at all. And she had just retired. And she sort of saw me in the street and she said, "I've got nothing to do all day. Do you want me to come over at like 7 a.m.? And I was like, "Yes, please."
That's amazing.
And the two of us, she was called Liz. She pushed the pram. We took the baby to swim classes. The two of us, like, she was an absolute lifesaver. And, you know, she didn't have any children of her own. The two of us used to do everything with the baby. She used to cook me lunch. It was like a miracle, you know?
That's amazing. That's a beautiful story. You're so fortunate.
Thank you. So listen, one of the things that really I did chuckle about, which I loved, is things to affirmations that you mention in the book. And how you sort of create boundaries to protect yourself. And one of your little tips, which I really enjoyed, was lying to relatives. So talk us through that one.
Yeah, there's things, you know, two of the chapters are, or maybe it's one chapter. It's all a blur to me now. But we talk about unsolicited advice. We talk about relationships changing. And setting boundaries is a big part of that. I have heard so many stories from new moms where, whether it's their parents, their partner's parents, friends, just bombarding them and kind of stepping in and taking over. Everyone responds to that differently. For me, my husband and I were incredibly close with my parents. My mother was a retired nurse. We welcomed that. We wanted them. We asked them to come and stay with us. A lot of people don't feel that way. There was one story that didn't make it into the book, but always struck me, was this woman had given birth and was kind of brought back into her room, and her in-laws were there, her, you know, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, the brother-in-law's girlfriend. She said the room was just packed with her partner's family members, and they were holding the baby before her. She couldn't even, they were passing the baby around. And finally she just snapped and said, "I haven't held him yet. Can I, you know, I need to hold my baby." And it sounds extreme, but those things do happen. And I think it begins even before your child is born. You need to really sit down and think, who do I want around? What am I going to be comfortable with? And discuss it with your partner. Keep in mind, once the baby comes out, that could all change. You could want more, you could want less. Ultimately, it's about you. It isn't about someone else saying they need to see the baby or need to meet the baby. I mean, that's wonderful. And you don't want to deprive people of that, but it needs to be within your comfort level. So maybe instead of having these neighbors who want to come by, or anyone who wants to come by, and you think that's great, but I know in my mind, I can only have them here for half an hour or an hour or something like that. You can set parameters up front. And if you're uncomfortable saying the truth, which is, I don't want, you know, we need to keep it short, I need a short visit, you can lie. You can blame your doctor. Many doctors said that they outright tell their patients, throw me under the bus. So you can say, my doctor said I need to make sure I get this many naps or this much sleep. So you're welcome to stay until 2 o'clock. But after that, I need to sleep. You could say something, we've got this wonderful technology now with Zoom. You could say, we're going to Zoom with my grandmother at 5:30. So you're welcome to come at 5, but at 5:30, we need to wrap it up. And I know, no, you know, we don't want to lie. And of course, we shouldn't lie. I think these are more fibs to maintain our sanity. And you're not trying to hurt anyone. You're not trying to be cruel or malicious. You need to look out for yourself.
And I think that, you know, it's about, again, coping and being able to, you know, you have to be so assertive about your own needs at that delicate point, don't you?
You absolutely, because no one is going to do it for you. Of course, there are some partners that just know exactly what to do, but that's not the case for most of them. They need to be told. They need to be taught. That's why I love when fathers read my book, especially before their baby is born, because I do think it helps them understand more where they can step in, where their voice can be beneficial. But rarely is anyone going to come to you and sit down and say, tell me what you need. How can I help you? Because no one is thinking about the mom. The focus is on the baby, the baby, the baby, the baby. The mother is seen as this afterthought. You brought the baby into the world. You're here to care for the baby. How are you doing? You're good? Okay, can I hold the baby now?
Well, that prompted, obviously, the title of your book.
Yes, exactly. Enough about the baby. Yes. I'm not a baby expert. I am not a pediatrician. There's plenty of books for that. There are plenty of people around you to look after your baby. What I'm saying is forget the baby for a minute, even 30 seconds, and focus on yourself. And if you don't see the value in that, think of your baby. Babies need happy mothers. They need to be in a good environment. I was so depressed. I had postpartum depression, but I also had all of these things that I expected would happen that wouldn't happen that also made me depressed. And I didn't leave the house a lot of days. I'm sure it would have been wonderful to take my baby for a walk around the block even, but I didn't have it in me because I was a mess. I was falling apart. And I think that had someone come to me and said, it's not selfish. If you can't see the value in doing this for yourself, then do it for your child. That probably would have made me think a little differently.
That's right. It's about parental mental health at the end, maternal mental health.
Exactly.
That's really what your book sort of documents.
Yeah.
And you mentioned sort of partners reading it. You know, I think that one of the things I really like about your book is you tell your story, but equally it's sprinkled with experts who do dip in from time to time and give, you know, an evidence-based kind of view on particular topics, which is really, really useful. And also at the back of the book, it's very practical. You give kind of real life practical lists for parents who actually are about to go to the hospital. You know, it's really, really sensible advice. It's not kind of, you know, utopian.
Yeah. Yeah, those lists were really important. I didn't want this to just be a recounting of my story. Who wants to hear that? Who am I? That's great. So the book really is a collection. I use my story to kind of carry the book along, but it's about mothers in general. I have stories from real moms in the book, as you mentioned, experts, and the lists at the back are, it's not something I sat down and wrote in a bubble. Those are things that I wrote by talking, again, to these experts, to mothers, to as many mothers as I could and put them together. So it's kind of, again, this everything I wish I had known. It starts with the packing list for the hospital. Again, just simple things you wouldn't think of, but when you read them, it's kind of, oh, that's a good idea. And things like an extra long cord for your phone, which somebody pointed out to me and is so true. It's a hospital. It's not a hotel room. It's not designed for you to have plugs and chargers right next to your bed or be convenient. So sometimes you need to think about that, or a sleep mask, or even your own shampoo. Just little tips that can help make your experience better. And it goes as far as to go into questions you need to discuss with your partner before your baby is born, ideally maybe even before you get pregnant. And those are really personal because they come not just from me, but from other mothers directly, some of whom share their stories in the book, that things come up that you assume won't after your baby. Like suddenly, I remember someone had told me that their husband wasn't very active in religion and there was no talk about what kind of schooling or education the child would have. And then all of a sudden he says, well, my child needs to go to Catholic school and that's this hill I'm willing to die upon. And by the way, it's incredibly expensive. And those types of things happen all the time. And so the list is very extensive and it's very exhaustive, but it can save you so much heartache and fighting and just really put you more on the same page as your partner. That alignment is so important.
And Becky, how do you wish people feel after reading your book? How did you, you know, what's the kind of, how do you want them to feel?
I want them to feel, you know, I suppose it's different at different stages. If they are thinking of having a baby or pregnant, I want them to feel excited and empowered by this knowledge and more prepared in a different way. I'm not teaching you how to install a car seat or infant CPR. I'm preparing the women to have a better understanding of motherhood, a better idea of what they need, and hopefully giving them permission to take it. I want them to be excited thinking, I've got this just one more great tool in my toolkit as I embark upon this next chapter. I want current moms with babies or older, anyone. I've had even women who are in their 60s and 70s who are grandmothers write me and tell me this. I want them to feel seen and feel okay and realize that they didn't do anything wrong. They weren't the only ones who struggled and that we all go through this. And that's something that is so important, I think, for people to know. And to your point also, that reminiscing. There's been a lot of women who said, I forgot about this part and it was something awful. It was something that I didn't, that traumatized me at the time. I've since moved on. But like you said, I never healed from it. Maybe it was the fighting and the resentment with their husband or friendships changing. But reading about it, reflecting, kind of going through what the experts say in the book gave them a sense of peace about it. And I think that's a really beautiful thing.
So Becky, it's written primarily, presumably for a US audience, but you must have had lots of global commentary on it, given you've got a wonderful Instagram account. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the reception you've had to it.
Yeah, well, it is, as you said, definitely for the US audience. Obviously, we here, it's very different from the UK. I admire and envy your system with midwives and just the way mothers are also treated as something important. Whereas here in the US, once you leave the hospital, unless there's a terrible complication, you don't see your doctor for 6 weeks. So there's, you know, bits and pieces. I would have loved to have, you know, taken the book, broken it down and made it exactly something for every audience. So I always say for readers in the UK, especially maybe if you're not having your baby in the hospital, like maybe like the first two chapters don't necessarily relate, but the overall theme and the feelings do. I have really just, it's amazing. I mean, I've had women in the UK to, you know, other continents, other countries just saying, I saw myself in this book. And, you know, if you want to be a stickler for details, sure, it does focus on my story, which takes me through the American healthcare system. But overall, being a mother, these thoughts, these feelings are universal.
And also people are enjoying following your journey and your funny commentary and, you know, family stories on your Instagram account. So tell us, what's that called? How can people stay in touch with everything that you read or produce?
Yeah, I always say I do my best work on Instagram, and that is Witty Otter. That's my Instagram page. That's the best place to find me, and it links you to also my Facebook page, my Twitter page, my Threads page, which is the new thing. I am not on TikTok. I apologize. I'm too old for TikTok, I say.
Well, listen, Becky, honestly, thank you so much for producing such an amazing guide and holistic look at that first year of motherhood. It's a brilliant purchase, I think, for anyone who's sitting there feeding their baby, looking for something to read, because there really is perhaps a village in that book. So thank you so much for your contribution today. And I really hope we can stay in touch, mother to mother, country to country.
Yes, I would love that. Thank you so much. And I loved your questions. And hopefully this is just another, this conversation can also reach mothers who need it. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Becky. All the very best to you.
Thank you.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.